It's the Plus One podcast from NPR Music. I'm Robin Hilton. Today, a conversation with singer Katie Lang.
Keen to the shifting wind, I bend to it blind. To rid these kisses of sin that must stay behind.
This song is called Season of Hollow Soul, and it's just one of the cuts from Katie Lang's remarkable 1992 record, Ingenue. The album was a monstrous hit for her, but it was also one of the decade's most important records. Nothing really sounded like it at the time. Ingenue was slow and languid. It had clarinets and accordions and this old Eastern European flair to it, all at a time when grunge and hip-hop were the ascendant sounds. But Ingenue was also important because it was filled with these seductive love songs that were written and sung by an openly gay woman. This was virtually unheard of at the time, and it helped change the national conversation about what it means to be gay. This year marks Ingenue's 25th birthday. Nonesuch Records is releasing a remastered version of the album, along with some unreleased live tracks. Last year, Katie Lang made a record with Nico Case and Laura Veers. They toured together and got to be friends. So we asked Laura Veers to talk with Katie Lang about Ingenue and how it still resonates today. Laura Veers started off the conversation with a story about how she first heard Ingenue. She says she'd graduated from high school in 1992 and moved to Malaysia with her family.
My brother's girlfriend at the time gave me the record. And I remember staring at it on this, we lived in this rental house in Malaysia with all white everywhere, white floors, tile floors. And I would lie, because it was really hot there, I would lie on the cold tile floor and look at the cover and listen to the record over and over.
Oh, I love that.
And yeah, it was beautiful. And I was lonely. I was by myself in this foreign country and feeling very insecure at that time as a teenager, not sure what I was going to do. I was not a musician at that time. But what I remember feeling was this sense of solace and self-assurance coming from this CD. And that was something I was going to ask KD about, is how can you do that at such a young age or at all? Is there someone that early on helped you believe in yourself and gave you the confidence? Because I think so much of singing is about confidence.
Yeah, my parents were definitely instrumental in building my confidence. They told me, you don't need to wear makeup. You can do whatever you want. If you want to play baseball, play baseball. If you want to make music, make music. They supported me in any direction. And I was the youngest of four children who all studied music. So music was just so much a part of our household. So I think the confidence really came from my parents.
And later on, when you got the deal with Roy Orbison, when he asked you to sing with him on Crying, was that another stamp, like, all right, I can do this? Like, was he a hero of yours when he...
No, he wasn't really.
Okay.
He became a hero of mine when I worked with him and when I worked on Black and White Nights. But, yeah, I guess my focus was other places when mm-hmm. I was younger. But I think when I made Ingenue, when Ben and I made Ingenue, we were consciously aware of the fact that no one was kind of making this kind of Eastern European dirge that Ingenue came out as. And I purposely wanted to sing unornamented, because ornamentation was really starting to take off in pop music. And I felt like, actually, I feel like the truth is centered, and it's still, and it's very plain. So I really consciously went against the grain with this record.
It's funny you talk about how it didn't really sound like anything else, because I was thinking that too. And this morning I was racking my brain trying to think of anything else that sounded like this. And the only thing I could come up with that was maybe close is maybe Chris Isaak at the time.
Yeah, well, Chris and I sort of paralleled each other in the country thing, too, and also our relationship with Roy, we kind of went along the same path a little bit, so that doesn't surprise me.
Did it take a long time to write the songs for this record?
It didn't take very long to write the music. When I work with Ben Mink, when I work with most collaborators, we come up with the music first. which is very easy, and but then puts me as a lyricist in a very difficult spot, because then I had to write lyrics that conveyed my emotion but also fit and sang into the music and sang well, which is a lot of it's a lot of perimeters for writing lyrics. And yes, the lyrics were a struggle. It took me 6 or 7 months to get the lyrics for this.
What about Constant Craving? I heard that you didn't really like that one at first, or?
No, I didn't. I didn't, because I felt like it was incongruent to the rest of the record. And it's funny, because yesterday in rehearsals of Ingenue, for the first time, I felt what its purpose was and why we put it on as the last song on the record, because it's an acquiesce. It's a summation of human desire. It's like, yes, okay, we all are heartbroken. We're all nervous. We're all vulnerable. We're all hopeful. But at the end of the day, Constant Craving has always been. And it really emotionally just surfaced for me, the purpose of that song.
How nice, 25 years later.
25 years later, I finally get it. But it's you know, we're doing the record in sequence on tour in Australia next week, in sequence in its entirety. So to have Constant Craving come at the end of this very insular, quiet performance is fascinating.
It's kind of a relief or a release at the end. But so that was a very conscious choice.
It's kind of a post-disclaimer.
So that was conscious.
Yeah.
To put it at the end.
Yes.
Did you realize it was the single before it came out?
Yes, we did. And that was also against the grain, because at that time, record companies wanted it as the first song on the album or the second song, so that when people like just kind of skip through songs to see if there's any good songs on it.
So how did you get that past the committees?
I don't know. I just guess we just had enough conviction.
Can we hear a little bit of Constant Craving? I just want to play a little bit here.
How'd you guys think up that? That's such a hook, that accordion line.
I just came up with it on the piano when we wrote it, and I just was playing it on a little Casio keyboard, and then Teddy Borowicki, who played the accordion, played it, and yeah, it became iconic.
Yeah, and I love the offset backing vocals. They're not in
they're
sync.
Yeah, they're off. Yeah.
Did you sing those?
Yes.
You did all the backing vocals on the record?
Yes, yeah, I did, yeah.
It's very cool.
So you say you're playing the whole record start to finish in this live tour in Australia, and you've come to understand this song better after 25 years. I'm wondering what it's like for you to work through these songs again and to hear them so intimately again.
Yeah, it was an interesting journey. When I first pulled the record up, because I don't listen to my own music. I pulled it up maybe about a year ago to start preparing for this, and it was so difficult to listen to it. I thought, I was like, oh man, really? This is Ingenue? It's really not that good. And I was so nervous and I was freaking out. But then, like, the second and third times I listened to it, it started to pull me in. And I started to develop a whole new relationship with it. And I guess ultimately I came to the conclusion that my job now, 25 years later, is to perform and to offer Ingenue up as neutral and as open as possible, because it's like a film director making a movie about a book that has had a that the audience has had a relationship with for 25 years. You don't, like, yours is a breakup and some people's is a hookup and some people is in Malaysia on the tile floor. So my job is just to be open to all those interpretations and just to deliver it as open and as available as possible. So, yeah, it's going to be very, very interesting. Of course, my own memories of it went flooding past when I listened to it. But then, you know, also I have the touring and the 25 years of having it under my belt and the relationship of its success and coming off of that. And yeah, it's got a lot of ingredients to it now.
Well, I was going to ask about the recording of the album. Where mm-hmm. did you record it?
We recorded it in Vancouver, in North Vancouver, or East Vancouver, at a studio. And it took us a long time, really, really, really long time, because it's so empty mm-hmm. and it's so orchestrated. And I think we had three Studers, which are tape machines, 3 24-track machines, synced, and we had, like, all, you know, so many tracks. There were so many tracks. I mean, Ben did all the string parts just by himself, overdubbing, and I did all the vocal parts. So, and that was before computers. That was before you could, you know, mix things down onto a computer.
And so you were punching in on the tape if you made a mistake.
And yep, editing, cutting tape, punching in on tape. So it was a very long process.
A few months or a year, or how long do you remember?
Oh, man. I think it was definitely at least 6 months.
Doesn't sound like it.
No?
Sounds easy.
Oh.
That's the trick of art,
Well,
though.
It does sound easy. It definitely sounds easy, yeah. And it is essentially a pretty simple record. But what's not simple about it is the intimacy, as I'm finding out now and trying to perform it again.
And what about the lyrics? Do you still relate to them? Were the songs about things in your life that now are long past that you think, well, like, oh man, I can't sing about that anymore? Or are they open enough that you can put your new life into them?
Yeah, I've always had an MO in lyric writing that they can be applied to any life situation, your dog, your mom, your lover, God, yourself. So I've tried to always write lyrics in a very open way. So yeah, they're not moment specific.
And how about the fame that came with this record? How did you stay grounded? Because I know that a lot of people just, like, crash their Porsches into palm trees and stuff like that.
I'm not sure I didn't, but I just walked away, though. it was kind of crashing a Porsche into a palm tree. That's a really good, it was kind of like that.
I can't see it. I can't see you doing that. You seem simple and grounded now. Did it get away from you?
Well, Yes, it did get away from me, because when you tour, we toured this record for, I think, 18 or 24 months. I mean, it was worldwide, and it was just going and going and going. And that's after 2 years at least of writing and recording it, and plus like 6 months of promo, you know, flying around and promoting it. So it's a huge commitment when you have a hit, then it just keeps going and you're exhausted but yet it's a bubble that is completely focused on you, centered around you. Everyone's interest is in you, their own best interest is in your success. So they all make it possible for you to keep going. So you think everything's fantastic. And I just started getting tired, and a few things happened where I realized, oh man, I got caught. I got caught up in the mindset of success, and then I started getting mad at myself. And yeah, I mean, then the record that followed, Ingenue was All You Can Eat, so which was a commentary on my eyes were bigger than my stomach kind of thing.
So was your interest in Buddhism around this issue of like searching for a center or groundedness that you'd lost?
No, I think my interest in Buddhism was always there. And I think in the lyrics of Ingenue, you can hear it starting to come out. My formal practice didn't start till 2000, so way later. But yeah, I think my interest in it and my searching for the path was definitely there.
Laura, did you have a song in mind, of one that particularly stands out to you on the record that we could hear?
I love Wash Me Clean, and I saw a dirty car that said Wash Me on it today, and it reminded me Wash Me Clean. That's my favorite on the record.
I'm not just saying this. I actually was staring right at that song and thinking, I'd like to play Wash Me Clean. I'll ask Laura what she wants to hear.
There we go. So.
It's also my favorite song on the record.
Oh, good to know. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it is.
Swim through my veins, drown me in your rain. My desire carries no shame. My will harbor no pain.
What is it about this song, Laura, that affects you?
How the F did someone do that? How's that possible? I mean, I'm struck by how difficult that is as a musician, having done this 25 years myself. It's so difficult to be that relaxed, to have the band sound that relaxed, to have your voice be that relaxed and that clear and open and vulnerable yet strong. It's very, very difficult to do. I couldn't do that. And that's not my wheelhouse. That's Katie's wheelhouse. That's her languid Lang sound. And I'm more of an up-tempo person, and I admire that down-tempo stuff. And pulling that off with what appears to be ease is the trick of, it's one of her true gifts, because that is not easy to do at all. It's incredibly difficult. Hardly anyone can do that.
It's a tremendous amount of restraint and control, like you say. Yes, we're talking about you. We're just going to have this conversation.
So anyway, more about Katie.
With you sitting here.
It's interesting because, again, once we're starting rehearsals, you know, the idea of restraint, because so much is Americana now, you know, so much is about kind of being loose and kind of freewheeling in music now. And we had to sit down and go, okay, this has to be played with absolute restraint and precision, almost like a classical music, because it's so much about ingenue, I think, is the space.
It'd be very easy to step on these songs.
Yeah, it would be very easy. And hopefully we're not going to do that.
Do you think that you're coming out as a lesbian? You were one of the first pop stars to come out. Had something to do with the Runaway hit, like the controversy
totally.
Of you on that cover with Cindy
Absolutely.
Crawford, and I mean, it's awesome. And it's very brave, too. Was that difficult, or were you like, all right, I'm ready to do this?
Both. First of all, the tempo of the record was nerve-wracking because I thought that I would get killed for it being so slow. So I just wanted to throw that in. And there was a lot of criticism on the record when it first came out. But I think then the traction of Constant Craving, and then, of course, the interview of me coming out with The Advocate led to the cover of Vanity Fair, which led to Constant Craving going number one. It was all co-mingled and interdependent, and I was scared. I was scared, but I already sort of shunned the whole, like, letting go of the country thing and shifting and... I'd gotten to a place where I went, it doesn't matter. I mean, what matters is that my music is honest, and if I don't have success, I'm doing something that's honest. And then the same with coming out is that I felt that there was so much pressure at that time. Queer Nation was outing people, and AIDS was in full-blown mode back then in the press and in life. And I just felt like I have a responsibility to come out and take some of the air, like deflame it a little bit. And the record company didn't want me to do it. My manager didn't know. People were afraid that it was going to have a negative effect on the record and on my career. And I had no idea.
That was awesome. I'm glad you did that.
I'm glad I did it too. Thank you. I'm really, really proud that I did that now.
And for the people who are grown adults now who weren't even born when this record came out, but the landscape was just so different and 25 years ago. And I when I think about the reasons why this record's important to me, one of them is because it was sort of the first in a series of important cultural touchstones. You know, soon after that, Philadelphia, the movie Philadelphia came out. We had Angels in America, and then Ellen DeGeneres came out, and then there was, you know, Will and Grace, and all of these things that sort of, I don't know if normalized is the right word to use, but mainstreamed what it meant to be gay. Mm-hmm. And Ingenue, I think of as being one of the first, and I was going to ask you if, when you made the record, if you had this in mind, but it sounds like...
Yeah, no, the songs were written for a woman, of course, but... I didn't make the record to have it be a platform for my coming out. I just felt like there was just always so much focus on my sexuality. And especially, like, there was a lot of focus on my quiet, sort of subversive interest in my sexuality during my Nashville period. But I don't think anyone was really wanting to know the answer when I was in Nashville. But when I switched to pop music, then people really wanted to know. It was kind of a more open playing field, you know. People wanted to know. And there was so much, every interview, we're still talking about it. So it's like, imagine what it was like back then. I mean, I was doing this Connie Chung interview where she asked me about 5 times within one interview. And then I just finally went, you know what? Gosh, I don't think I was ever in the closet, but I just finally brought it out.
I just wanted to thank you for believing in me, because you asked me to be in K Slang Beers, which was the band that we made a record and toured it. And I feel like I grew a lot as an artist through working with you and Nico Case, and learning how to sing better and learning how to be a better writer, songwriter, and performer. So I just wanted to ask you what keeps you wanting to do music? Why do you like to sing?
Well, I guess I'm an apple tree and I make apples. That's what I do. But I love to sing. I'm a singer. And I think the business makes it difficult sometimes. I think, you know, I'm very, very choosy about what I want to do. And now I choose to do stuff that really is meaningful and that matters to me. And, you know, Case Langvier's was one of those things that really rejuvenated my love of music and my love of musicians and writers and the struggle that we go through to produce, to create.
Katie, is there a song that if we went out on that you would pick from this, from Ingenue, what would it be?
I think maybe Save Me.
I'm telling you, we're some astral plane right now. I was looking at Save Me and thinking Save Me is the song to go out on. You know, I want to say, too, just thank you so much for doing this and for making this wonderful music that has certainly meant a lot to me over the years, but I know has also been an important part of so many other people's lives as well.
Thank you so much for your interest in the record. I really appreciate it.
Singer Katie Lang talking about the 25th anniversary of her album Ingenue with Laura Beers. The remastered version of the record, along with previously unreleased live tracks, is out July 14th. For NPR Music and All Songs Considered, I'm Robin Hilton.
Save me.